The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, we'll learn what's keeping more nurses from graduating. A newly identified species of tarantula is setting a record among large furry spiders, and humans are not the only ones with an affinity for beautiful crystals. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. While nursing remains a popular career path for prospective students, bottlenecks in the pipeline to train future healthcare workers persist in New York State. A new report from the University at Albany's Center for Health Workforce Studies finds the number of graduating nursing students has remained stable in recent years, but many nursing program applicants are being turned away. To learn more about the barriers preventing New York from growing its healthcare workforce, I spoke with CHWS Senior Program Manager Robert Martiniano and Communications Director Leanne Keough.
You know, what we've seen historically is nursing is cyclical. We have ups and downs, and we've had a slight uptake after COVID, but it's leveled off in the last 4 or 5 years. So we've seen graduations pretty much be stable since 2020, between 2020 and 2024, they've really been fairly even.
That's a good thing, right? Because that's predictable for employers. Are there any benefits to making sure that, hey, the numbers, at least they aren't declining a significant rate?
Yeah, it's good and bad. So you're right. It's stable, and we can predict the number of RNs that are coming out of the pipeline. The problem is when you look at the Department of Labor projections, it's woefully inadequate for what they predict we're going to need going forward.
Yeah. What are some of the barriers that are preventing that number from actually ticking higher? I'm imagining that nursing is a career that a lot of people are, in fact, interested in. What is actually preventing the number of graduates from increasing despite that need that is continuing to grow, as you just mentioned?
I think there are two things, and I'll start with the second one first. That we look at the RN production, and we see bottlenecks there. It's difficult getting faculty. When you look at faculty salaries versus bedside salaries, we see a huge disparity. And Leanne can talk about that in a little bit.
Absolutely. We did a study that was recently published in Nurse Educator that really dove into those salary differences between nursing faculty and clinical nurses. And it's a big difference, and it's deterring, I think, a lot of nurses from going the teaching route. You know, those salary differences between staff nurses is over $18,000 difference. Between charge nurses is almost $20,000 difference. And between frontline nurse managers, it's close to $28,000 difference. So those are really significant numbers that I think are deterring people from doing full-time nursing faculty and why we have those shortages in the pipeline.
Right. I would say if I was a healthcare worker and I'm going to spend more hours of my week doing X activity, I would rather earn overtime at work than spend that time for less pay teaching at a university.
Right. The other thing that we found that is really significant and interesting is that nursing faculty usually have higher degrees, more advanced degrees than clinical nurses, and they also have a lot more experience in the nursing field. We're looking at 89% of nursing faculty have a master's degree or higher versus only 19% for clinical nurses. And 59% have over 21 years experience versus only 29% for clinical nurses. So again, they have more education, they have more experience, which usually those are factors that indicate a higher salary, right? But in this case, it's just the opposite.
So is UAlbany doing anything to actually address this bottleneck where we have, sure, a steady number of people who are interested in becoming nurses, but it's actually harder to hold on to and keep up with the demand for teachers?
So a couple of things have been happening at UAlbany. One, they have now a written agreement with Albany Med to actually train nurses and provide nurses. So that's helped. In the last number of years, we've seen a number of schools close. St. Rose closed. They had a nursing program. We've seen a couple of schools close in the lower Hudson Valley, some out west, and all of them had nursing programs. So we've seen some reductions in nursing schools. We've also seen some additions in nursing schools. UAlbany just started one, and we've seen a few schools increase their pipeline. But again, so UAlbany has, they started a program. It's a 4-year degree. They also have, are working with Albany Med right now in terms of training their nurses. So I think there are a number of things they're doing. But again, some of the, you know, we've talked just about nursing faculty issues, but there's also clinical training issues that there just are not enough clinical training sites for these nurses. And the deans and directors that we surveyed talked about that. Also, many of these programs have caps on the number of students that can be accepted. You know, you think about nursing, there's a cost to that. There's cost to education. And when you add the cost of clinical training into nursing, where you're having to send faculty to supervise them, to mentor them or precept them at a hospital, that's a cost too. So you're seeing a lot of limitations on program expansion.
And people being turned away.
Yes. You know, and the other thing is, it's not just people being turned away, but when you look at the population statistics in rural areas, you're not seeing as many rural people going on for secondary education. It's hard to talk about nursing. It's hard to talk about physician assistants or nurse practitioners or occupational therapists or physical therapists when you're just not going past high school. And I think it's broader than just talking to the healthcare providers or the educators. You need to get to those kids in high school and sometimes middle school to give them an idea of the type of things they can do.
And yeah, I want to talk about some of those long-term strategies in addressing these issues when we're talking about the bottlenecks, the shortage of staff and training centers and the rest of it. What needs to happen looking long-term as the demand for nursing and healthcare professionals increases?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think introducing nursing careers and other healthcare careers in high school and in middle school helps. And there are a number of programs out there. So area health education centers do that. They're all through the state. They're all through the country. And they work with students to try to introduce them to health careers. I also think we see a lot of older adults or second career adults going into nursing. And it's a different breed of people, so to speak, that they need supports around them. It's not just for these second career adults. It's not just giving tuition or scholarships. You have to do wraparound services. You have, because many of them have children at home. Many of them may have adults they're taking care of, older adults. And so you need to build wraparound services around these people in order to make them successful.
Sure, and I'm just thinking of the free community college tuition program that New York has been employing in the last couple of years, and nursing is one of those careers that's on the list. So are we seeing an interest just on that topic of older adults actually going back to school and training to become nurses?
Yes. There are a number of programs that Department of Health is funding right now. The 1115 waiver they've been doing for a couple years, that's ending in next March. They're also doing the HELP program that includes not only tuition, but the wraparound services. And that's all throughout New York State.
And anything else about this particular study and looking at the trends over the last 10 years, Robert or Leanne, that you'd like to mention that's worthy of mentioning in this report?
Well, I think, you know, we've talked about the faculty and program caps and issues. You know, one of the things that many of the nurse faculty are talking about and nurse directors are talking about is the use of simulation because there's not enough clinical training sites. New York passed a law that allows nursing programs to do some of that clinical through simulation, and you're seeing programs do a lot more of that. And there's good and bad to that. Obviously, they get some of the clinical training, but they're not dealing with real patients. We did a study a couple of years ago that, and the CNOs, the chief nursing officers at hospitals, talked about this, that simulation is great, but the students that are coming out may not be dealing with the patients as much because of simulation. So there's good and bad with that.
Yeah, they found that, especially during the pandemic, they increased the use of simulation more than they ever had before in order to ensure on-time graduations. Associate was successful in that instance, but what we found when we were, as Robert was saying, as we were speaking to the nursing officers at the hospital, is that a lot of those new nurses were coming in lacking those communication skills because they weren't interacting with actual human beings. And, you know, I think people forget about that. And nursing is a people-facing occupation. And those skills are so vitally important. So I think, you know, if programs are going to be using simulation more, which I think, you know, they are, New York State passed a law somewhat recently saying, up to 30%, I believe, of clinical training can be done through simulation. I think what's important is that they keep in mind that they also have to be teaching them those communication skills and those people interacting skills. And that's really important in order to ensure their success.
The other thing you have to think about in terms of nursing, not so much the pipeline, but how to retain nurses in the healthcare settings. You know, the study that we're referencing, a lot of people talked about workplace culture and that, and there's one quote that just sticks in my mind every time I talk to people, I talk about it. He goes, no matter how much we pay them, no matter what type of benefits we give them, if we have a poor workplace culture, they're not going to stay. And so people are looking at ways to retain nurses. So, you know, it's not just about increasing the pipeline, but how do you retain the existing workforce? They're looking at that. You know, the other thing is it's not just for nursing, but healthcare in general. There's so many other jobs out there right now for people, for nurses that are outside the healthcare field. And they're looking at them. They sometimes pay better. You know, they're 9-to-5 jobs. I mean, all those things that create a work-life balance. And they're looking at those. So it's not just, again, about creating a pipeline, but trying to ensure that you're keeping your existing workforce.
Well, Robert and Leanne, thank you so much for coming in to speak about it. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's Robert Martiniano and Leanne Keough from the Center for Health Workforce Studies at the University at Albany. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. A recently identified species of tarantula is setting a record in the world of spiders. Satyrix ferox, found in Oman and Yemen, can reach sizes of more than 5 inches long. But what makes it unique is its long mating appendages. Males have the longest front appendages, called palps, of all identified tarantulas, and they help improve the chances of survival in the species' aggressive mating behavior. To learn more about the spider and the discovery, I spoke with Alireza Zamani, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Turku in Finland.
Well, we named it Satyrix ferox. It's a species occurring in Yemen and Oman. It is quite a large-sized tarantula, relatively large-sized tarantula. It could reach a leg span of about 14 centimeters. The females are quite defensive in behavior, at least they are the most defensive spider that I have seen. And they're fossorial, they live under ground in burrows. And so they are one thing that is quite interesting about them and sets them apart from almost all other tarantulas is the length of the male copulatory appendages, which are the longest in the entire family. While in Typical tarantulas, the length of these appendages is around 1.5 times the length of the frontal part of the body. In these tarantulas, these appendages could reach almost 4 times the length of the frontal part of the body of the spider. So they are quite peculiar spiders.
So when you say that the female spiders are particularly defensive, what does the actual mating dance look like when one of the male spiders approaches the female spider, the males with these very long mating appendages? What happens? How does the female respond?
Well, we no one has observed the mating behavior of this species yet. But in general, tarantulas do not display complex courtship behaviors. Typically, in tarantulas, when the male finds a female, for a few minutes, he simply vibrates the silken threads of a retreat. And then once the female comes out of her retreat, he starts to gently stroke her appendages before initiating mating. And most male tarantulas have special hooks on their frontal pair of legs that lock into the female's fangs during mating to prevent her from attacking the male. So we assume that, and our species also have this hook. So we assume that generally the mating pattern is similar to what has been documented in most other tarantulas. But if we take into account the length of these mating appendages, we hypothesize that the males try to keep a larger distance from the female by extending their very long mating appendages so that there would be even a lesser chance of the female attacking them, even though they do have the hooks and, well, we assume that they would lock into the female's fangs.
Now,
that's our current assumption.
Do you have any belief as to why the mating ritual for tarantulas is so potentially violent that the females do have to be so defensive and... Sure. Obviously, this species has these very long mating appendages, which may help the mating process. But why do they act like this?
I mean, generally, most species of spiders, the females tend to try to attack the male once the male is trying to initiate mating. But different species use a variety of different approaches to, in a way, persuade the female into mating. Most species have courtship rituals to convey basically two messages to the female. The first message is that the approaching male is not a prey or a predator. And the second is that the male is of the same species as the female and is seeking reproduction. I could give a few examples of what's happening in other groups of spiders. For example, in some crab spiders, the male ties the female with multiple layers of silk before mating. In nursery web spiders, in some of them, the male presents a nuptial gift to the female. If the female accepts the gift, then he can proceed with the mating. And jumping spiders, they have unique, in a way, species-specific dance routines that perform for the female. And if the female likes the way that the male dances, then allows them to proceed with the mating. But in tarantulas, it's quite straightforward. It's basically just the messages are conveyed with just vibrations on the silk and on the ground. And generally speaking, tarantulas from the old world, from the Eastern Hemisphere, basically, tend to be more defensive and have more potent venoms in comparison to the tarantulas from the Americas. So, and our tarantulas also are from the Eastern Hemisphere. So there is a certain level of expected behavior associated with them. But even for an old world tarantula, they're still quite defensive.
Tell me, just backing up a little bit, about the process of finding this animal and identifying this animal and having to assign a new genus to the ferox species. Was that exciting as a researcher? What was that process like?
It was very, very exciting. So since about a decade ago, we already had an idea that based on pictures that were being shared on the internet, we already knew that there were some large black tarantulas with long pops occurring in Oman. But for a long time, it was assumed that this population in Oman belonged to an already known species, Monocentropus longimanus from Yemen. But it was still questionable because there is a distance of over 1,000 kilometers between the collection localities of in Oman and in Yemen. So here, my colleagues and I started to look into it. We gathered a set of material collected in the region, and we conducted the thorough morphological and genetic analysis. And we realized that, yeah, the Omani population belongs to different species, which we describe as Satyrix ferox. And also that we have three additional species new to science, all of them with elongated male palps. And we couldn't place them into any existing tarantulas, and therefore we had to establish a new genus to accommodate them and describe and name the four new species.
Now, was it easy to come up with the name? Was there any debate among you and your team?
Oh, it wasn't easy. I like to use this quote from Spider-Man, that with great power comes great responsibility. And I believe that once you have the power, in a way, to the species, that name will be used throughout the history, you kind of have the responsibility to choose an interesting name and choose a good name in a way that would fit species and would stick to minds in a way. So I personally, the process of deciding, coming up with a name for this genus, I think it took a little bit over a month for me, to come up with the name for this particular genus. So it was a bit difficult, but I'm very happy with the name that we ended up at the end.
I'm happy to hear it. Well, Ali Reza, thank you so much for taking the time. I also do just have to ask, one more thing before I let you go. Where will your research take you next? Are you going to continue studying tarantulas? What's next for you?
Oh, yeah, we are at the moment studying tarantulas of Madagascar and Middle East and the greater Middle East and Madagascar are the projects in line.
Well, best of luck in your studies, and thank you again. I appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
Ali Reza Zamani is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Turku in Finland. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Humans love shiny objects, and there's evidence that early hominids collected crystals. But we're not the only ones mesmerized by beautiful stones. Chimpanzees also have an affinity for crystals. The Best of Our Knowledge is Madeline Reynolds spoke with Juan Manuel Garcia Ruiz, a crystallographer and research professor at Donostia International Physics Center in Spain, about his research into the subject.
Now, our proposal is that crystal may help to teach our mind and the mind of the chimpanzees, to think with abstraction. Okay, to have something that is completely different than any other thing in nature. Okay, so we can see, we can see the object, the natural, but probably crystal were the object that triggered our interest in symbolic thoughts, symbolic thought, or the interest in abstraction, and our interest also probably in thinking about a beyond, because the chimpanzees that are there, okay, everything around them and everything around the hominid 800,000 years ago, everything was born and then was growing and then died, but the crystal, they just appeared there. So who made this? So because, well, this is something that appeared. So who made this? So clearly the people there did not. So maybe it's a beyond, there is something supernatural, something that is, you can call this God or you can call it extraterrestrial intelligence, whatever, but it's something that could be, one of the first way to think in something which is beyond, having extremely powerful, that is beyond ourselves.
I feel like that furthers the idea of how we interact with, for example, crystals in this retrospect. I mean, we're more similar than we think in how we interact with things. I think about humans today and how we use crystals, and we're always so fascinated by them, and people collect them. And I guess in this sense, you know, some of the chimpanzees that you used, you know, were collecting them and putting them in their little piles and stuff. It's just, it's a really interesting, interesting conclusions can be made about how we're still pretty similar in some ways.
Exactly. Yes. And also it will explain, I think, that because there are today that almost everybody like crystal. This is something that crystal today everybody like. And there are people who believe that the crystal have magical property, even healing properties, something like this. No proof of this, but there are many people who believe that. So, and maybe this is a way to explain, you know, why. Because we have crystal in our mind at least for 6 million years, we know now, right? So this is something that, crystal is there. So we were so fascinating, so early, you know, 6 million years ago. So far, maybe we have to do experiment with other apes, you know, to see, you know, how fast we can go back, you know. But then this is something that could explain why even today, we are so fascinated with crystals.
And I'm curious, for you, what was the most fascinating aspect of this research for this study, for you personally?
For me personally, is that is to confirm something that I was in some way expecting, because I have published a couple of papers before, you know, trying to explain what my suggestion about, my thought about why crystal should be appealing for the hominid, you know, and now we have this confirmation. So this is something. Actually, even the people working with my team, you know, the photographer, the people who were there, they were very skeptical, you know, about that. But then when you see there in vivo, you see the behavior of the chimpanzee, it was absolutely, you know, surprising.
That was Juan Manuel Garcia Ruiz, a crystallographer and research professor at Donostia International Physics Center in Spain. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1853. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio, thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.